Hello, I'm Rob Hirschfeld, CEO and co-founder of Rackn and your host for the Cloud 2030 podcast. Today's episode is a bit of a departure from where we are going normally, and a lot of fun. So I hope you will enjoy the conversation. This is part of a presentation that I've been preparing about comparing 125-year-old house building architecture, what you might call a legacy home, to modern DevOps and things that work and don't work and we need to be aware of. And we basically turned this over to the group to discuss. There are a lot of home maintenance stories and history here and comparison notes. And especially in the back half, we get into the very serious question of how this type of challenge directly 100% relates to IT and operations management. A ton of great lessons and reflections here. I know you will enjoy the discussion. The topic for today is actually old houses. So
legacy
houses. Thank you. Legacy houses. So that's perfectly appropriate, figuring out how to keep the old stuff running. Something that we don't do enough of anymore, sadly.
You know, for me, it's cathartic, but it's also infuriating, you know, to fix wiring and do, you know, I do all the maintenance on the cabin here. And right now we have three significant electrical issues that I need to troubleshoot. There's a
leak
in the plumbing. Uh-oh. And I don't know where it's coming from.
That's not good.
Is it definitely a plumbing leak? That's the problem.
Yeah, it's somewhere under the sink. The cabin is on the side of a mountain, so you can walk under the house easily.
Okay.
So I went in there and looked, and there you can see where the water had been running along the joist from the kitchen to under the bedroom, and like all the wood is just soaking wet. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I've got to fix that before we have rot issues.
That's hopefully there's no electrical near it.
The electrical runs in the attic and the plumbing runs in the flooring, so we're good there.
Okay.
I've got a leak. I think I patched it now somewhere and it doesn't matter where, but it was showing up. It was manifesting by pooling water in one of the light fixtures. So definitely an area of concern. I think I went out and tarred a flat roof, and hopefully I fixed it, and we'll see.
Well, you know, Rob, you can always call my son.
you have
the challenge is I think I need a roofer, not an electrician. But
you have a flat roof where you live?
We do. It was an addition that they put on, and so they bumped out. It's probably appropriate. I can give you a little of the history of the house. The neighbor is all 1900s houses. So 1903 type of era. And then, a lot of the houses, including mine, although I don't know how they did it, got converted into multifamily during the Depression. Yeah. My house has a
upstairs,
history.
Downstairs.
I think they did like front door and up to the second floor, and then because we have two staircases, so you can like split the second floor a little bit.
Got it.
But and then we have a third floor, and so I think like the basement, like they had the front of the base, like the front of the house and the back of the house a little bit. I would love to see floor plans if I can find them from that era, because I can see that we sort of have two front doors, but how they actually accomplished it, I have no idea. Like there's so much trying to figure out what people did when they did it in the house and generations. Because at this age, our house was one of the first ones to be electrified. So we we have the 1900s electrical, which is they put little
ceramic
things with wires,
isolators
going up.
It's called knob and tubing.
That's it, knob and tubing.
Exactly.
And yeah, so there's still places where there's tubes that were drilled through the floor for the electrical to go up, but that was clearly installed when they built the house. Because we have plaster lathing for most of the walls, and that's behind it. But then they use those tubes they put up electrical, the old 60s electrical, which is like the black conduit and the white wire in conduits. Yeah. That's what?
That's aluminum.
Oh, God. It's aluminum? Okay.
Yeah.
Which is going to be really funny because if you connect aluminum to copper, which is what I'm wearing now, it will corrode.
Yeah.
Then that's a fire. That becomes a heat and fire hazard. Yeah. I've been trying to replace stuff as I go. Happily, most of the electrical was replaced when they put in new fuse panel, the breaker panels instead of fuse panels. And so my electrical is pretty up to date with proper wiring and conduits. But every once in a while, you know, there's places in my house where there's a metal panel box, and there's a whole bunch of wires coming together with twist ties in it.
If you do need to connect copper to the aluminum, it actually might not even be up to code anymore because it's changed. I think it's changed in the past couple of years. But you said that you had to get the purple caps that have the gel.
Cool. I'll keep that. I'll look for that and keep that in mind.
They're legal now.
are they? God, there's so much of the stuff that's a mess. From that perspective,
it's kind of like going through a 20-year-old database and looking at stored procedure calls, right?
And that's actually the fun of so part of the topic for today is actually to go back through, talk about these items and then compare them back to lessons learned. Like that can be there's a talk in here that I was looking to give to be about how these are DevOps lessons and IT lessons. About when do you actually need to replace, strip out wiring and replace it, or like there's no, go ahead.
We should dress you up, and it won't take much, Rob. We dress you up like Bob Villa, this old house, and you go in.
If this talk ever gets accepted, I'll definitely do the Bob Villa. I'll get my flannels and
I love that guy.
It's funny to me. So let me finish the addition story, and then I'm still trying to figure out all the additions and changes. But one of the things they did that was really nice is one of our dining room, and then the guest bathroom. They pushed that out about 10 feet. So they extend the basement. And all that. So you can clearly see the construction lines where they added this additional piece, and they took the windows, and they like the windows are the original windows. So they just moved them out. Mm-hmm. So we sort of have this, and then they just put a flat roof over it instead of extending the roof line. So, it's flat roof is not as nice as the regular roof. And then we had a fire sometime, I don't know, dates this stuff, probably in the 70s. And so we no longer have the shingle roof that a lot of my neighbors have. Slate roof, sorry. Most of my neighbors have the original slate roofs on these houses. It's pretty common. And then, but we have shingles, which is nice, actually. I'm happy about that. The slate isn't. If something breaks a slate, it's incredibly expensive to fix it. Mm-hmm. But they're very good. They're very good roofs otherwise. But yeah, if you go up in the attic, you can see they replaced like most of the top of the roof, but you can see the scorch marks from where there was a fire up in the attic. you know, it's
oh my,
it's there's, I mean, when we have, we, there were termites in the house's history. So you can, if you go down to the basement, you can see places where they took termite boards and they put new boards on either side of it. What else? The original, they added radiators to the house in two passes. So they have the steam radiators. So you have all the pipes going up along the walls to get the radiators to the right places because they couldn't put them in the walls. And then they converted that to a water, low pressure water system. So there's a heat and a pump. But I just looked up the date for that. That was done in 1987. So that's a 35-year-old system, 40-year-old system. 35. I should be able to do that math. So at some point I'm hoping to switch that to a heat pump. Keep the forced water.
The pipes will make it easier, that's for sure.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. So I can just put a heat pump. And then if I'm not running gas, the gas is super expensive to run. And then it, you know, like it's fast. So, you know, in 20 minutes you can get the house up 10 or 15 degrees. But you're dumping a ton of gas to do that. So if I had a heat pump, I could just maintain the water temperature, you know, and that would actually do a nice job. But this is what's so fun. Like literally you're looking at a system where you're like, all right, I've got all the radiators in place. Can I change the engine, you know, the way the water gets heated, which we've done a couple times. But then if I switch it to a heat pump, then, you know, I have to make sure I have the electrical up, the electrical capacity to the house. To handle that, because the heat pump, that, you know, I'm going to draw more current. Although on balance with LED lighting, I'm drawing less current than
it's than about spec. Load, not current.
Yeah.
Right. It's the load that each appliance will take, that, you know, lighting takes, whether it's LED or not LED. It's about balancing the load, or that it is the amount of current, because the, you know, your hydro provider will always have a fixed amount of current coming in, right? Mm-hmm. Like 100 amps or whatever, right. Or 200 amps. The heat pump will take a lot. You might have to upgrade the panel, but that's irrespective. But either way, the one FYI, those old pipes that you have for the radiators, check those with a plumber first, because the amount of corrosion that might be in there could be epic.
Okay.
So before you do anything, have them flushed and make sure all the drainage is working properly. Otherwise, you're spending a lot of money to then spend a lot more money.
It's a good, okay.
Which is always fun.
Yeah, God.
That's the fun of it, right? Is that you're always fixing stuff,
something to do, right?
You know, you're adapting legacy systems as opposed to just ripping everything out and replacing it.
Well, that's this to me is, you know, transitioning it to from an IT perspective. There's two dilemmas here, or a couple of dilemmas. One is just knowing what was done, right? You know, there's so many times I'm you know, I don't know what something is until after, you know, I've had a chance to pull everything apart. I do know they took out all of the lead pipe, because there used to be lead pipe for the water, which is pretty common in Baltimore in general. And, you know, at least all of the plumbing I have, the water lines are all copper. So at some point they did that. I don't know. There's not a lot of, you know, we don't, just like in IT, we don't necessarily put a lot of documentation around what was changed or what went in. And so you really have to figure it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can the building department, I mean, I don't know if it's like here you have to, for some internal renovations, even if you're the homeowner, you still have to pull a permit. Right, and get inspections and whatever. Otherwise, you void your insurance, your home insurance policy. So from that perspective, maybe the building department would have records of the permits that were pulled. And you could find out that way.
It's worth checking, yeah.
Yeah, because the one concern that I would immediately come to mind is the plaster lathing that you have.
Mm-hmm.
How much asbestos is in there?
That's a good question. Most of it from the dates of the house, I have no idea how much asbestos they would have mixed in to do it. That's a good question. Other thing is, I'm sure there's lead paint, layers of lead paint in it too.
At the very least, you won't have to worry about having cardboard sewer pipes. Which was a thing in Canada after World War II.
Cardboard?
Yes, it was.
Cardboard?
Yes.
Yeah. What?
Cardboard.
I know about terracotta.
Cardboard?
But and
did like some
cardboard,
sort of,
huh?
Was it some sort of treated?
Yeah.
Treated board?
It was treated, yes, but I mean, in the end, it was still cardboard. Now, the fun thing is that they figure out how to upgrade them. So instead of like digging them out and replacing them, what they do is they essentially blow in a plastic liner.
That makes sense.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, there's certain parts in Toronto where as the city evolved, and I'm sure in Kitchener and where Klaus is, and across the province, certain eras of houses just like run. Don't even think about it. If it's a Victorian, like late 1800s, early 1900s, yeah, they could be restored. But yeah. Like just after the war in the 60s, and some parts of the 70s and even 80s, because there was such a boom that like, and so much payola going on in the industry that it was like, don't even bother, because you'll find walls with no insulation. You'll find aluminum, you know, wiring, everything that was not built to code. And it's just a nightmare. So realtors will tell you there are certain parts of the city, certain years, just don't even bother.
Yeah, there was a in the U.S. there was a plumbing system that predates PEX. Oh, what was it called? But yeah, there it's like if you have that, you have to rip out all of your plumbing and redo it. And this was, I forget what the name of it was, but it was like 60s, 50s, something like that.
Yeah, because it was just like, you know, the faster you can get the houses built, the more money you're going to make, and who gives a shit about, you know, the quality. But here now, even when they do appraisals, if you actually have copper piping instead of PEX, you get more value in terms of the value of the home.
Makes sense.
And the resale value and whatever. So,
I mean,
it's very interesting.
It's a funny. I mean, it's interesting to think of different eras, like boom bust eras impacting the housing construction. But I know it's true. Like the house we left in Austin was a 60s era, you know, slab construction. And Austin still does this. They do a whole bunch of slab construction, which I feel like is cheaper, faster.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to maintain. You get issues, you know, with whatever they put, like in New Orleans, are, you know, all the ground would literally sink under the houses and expose all the pipes, and then they break, and we'd have, there's all sorts of issues around that. Is this a testament for just, you know, going slow and investing better?
I think there's
It's builder consumer alignment too, right? You know, it's once the development is done and the builder moves on, there's no accountability for the house, you know, for the longevity and the maintenance cost and all of that. So there's kind of this disconnect, which kind of happens in IT too, right?
This is why the analogies are so good, right? We're looking at, you know, I feel like we go through boom bust cycles with these things too, and layoff cycles where, you know, you lose really critical, like in a house turning over, you lose critical knowledge of what was done. You know, I do stuff all the time thinking, okay, it's obvious, or I'm the homeowner, I'll remember.
You won't.
And nobody after me will find out. It's like walking up to my fuse panel and nobody ever labels it. You're always like, which fuse goes to what?
Yeah. Or the labels are wrong, like in this house. This house was built in 71 by my grandfather. And Joanne, there will be no record of any building permits pulled for any of the work that happened over the last half century. Put it that way. So I've got like one of my electrical issues. You'll love this. It's so weird that if you plug something into the outlet, it kills all of the outlets in both bedrooms. And I'm going like, well, how does that, you know, I have a degree in electrical engineering, so I'm not an idiot when it comes to electrons, but I can't for the life of me figure out what plugging in a charger for my phone into an 120 volt AC outlet would cause all the other outlets to stop working. And then when you unplug it, they start working again and everything's fine.
Yeah. It's the load. It's the load on the circuit.
It's almost definitely some sort of grounding issue.
Exactly.
Because if you plug it in, that creates a path to ground, but I don't know. It's just the grounding issues are very difficult to troubleshoot.
Yes.
Very, very difficult to troubleshoot. We had one in my old house and I actually couldn't figure out without turning off the power for the whole house. There was a circuit that you couldn't turn off because somebody had crossed wire somewhere.
I was going to say,
no idea.
So if you have a circuit tester, Tyler.
I have several.
Okay. And you have meters and everything else to go with it. When you test each circuit when you test each plug and you trace what circuit it's on back to the panel, chances are very likely that the load, there's too many devices on the one circuit that's going back to the panel. And so every time you plug that charger in, you're basically tripping the breaker for the rest of the room. So none of the outlets will work.
Expect that as well, except that it doesn't flip the breaker.
No,
literally.
Does the charger work?
No.
Yeah, because it's just enough to make it go into a trouble, but not enough to completely flip it.
Yeah.
I had that problem in my other house.
That would be easily tested by, let's say, replacing one of the other items on the breaker with, say, a space heater or something. And that should then give you the same symptoms. If it doesn't, then it's a grounding issue.
Yeah. Well, so the other thing is the outlets are all original. So the outlets are all 50 years old.
That's
the problem. And they do the connection where they just stick it instead of using the screw.
That in itself is not bad, but
those contacts, when you just stick the wire in the back of the outlet, those contacts can come loose and break.
I'm going to replace all the outlets
and check all of the grounds and the wires and everything, because outlets are 50 years old anyway. So I kind of need to do that regardless.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, okay, it's time to retire that technical debt, as it were.
No, that is one of the things I'm slowly doing is trying to replace every outlet and switch. Those are your fire risks more than anything else.
And absolutely they are. And then if you've got a grandfather who, you know, who is the king of jury rigging, he had a different term for it, which is wildly offensive, I won't use. But let's just say that things were not done up to code.
Mm-hmm.
Understood. So what's, is there an IT equivalent that, for this that we're like, is this an observability thing? Is this what are
this equivalent in of, terms of
what you deal with, how you deal with it?
How you find these, like, we're talking about like replacing switches and outlets is, it's like, is that the equivalent of like making sure that your libraries are patched or, you know, what's
that's the, part of it, but yeah. You're, but the other, well, yes. Library patches, knowing, you know, all your, you know, running your dependencies, you know, really running them all the way as far back as you can figure. And the other aspect to your other point is observability. It's, and in many of the cases, it's data observability as much as it is anything else, network.
Actually obviously, watching, but, yeah.
Because it's also like, part of re-architecture, though. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, with your heating system, like, at some point, someone decided to, like, replace the steam heating system, the steam radiators with all kind of radiators.
Right.
That's not an upgrade. That's a replacement. Of course, now you have both, and you're maintaining your legacy system along the same, at the same time.
Yep.
You have to retire it at some point. So that's your tech debt.
It's an interesting thing to be able to do an incremental change out, right? Like swapping you know, one database for another, you know, that would be the equivalent from the heating system to me. It's like, yeah, I'm tired of paying for Oracle licenses or I can't get support for it. You know, I'm swapping to MySQL server or you know, switching database vendors from that perspective. If the database, actually, no, this is a good equivalency. So somewhere somebody went through in the old steam systems and said, instead of giving you a high pressure steam system, which is dangerous and, you know, and harder to maintain, we're going to switch you to a forced water system. And then the key to selling the forced water system was being able to say, we'll keep your radiators and piping in place, which to Joanne's point, could potentially, you know, cause its own issues and you need to evaluate the path as you're going.
I'm replacing the outlets is a little bit closer to the strangler pattern where you're slowly replacing bits and then you're left just with the skeleton that you eventually have to replace, aka redo the wiring.
Yeah. The thing that frustrates me on the wiring was that when they put in the wiring, they didn't think about any, there was no future, right? So one of the things that's frustrating to me, and I haven't seen this in other houses, is there aren't access paths necessarily built. So there isn't like a wiring conduit for the house to make it easy to pull any type of wiring between the floors or through any access. So
and you can't,
you still don't, you
can't
get that use in those buildings old... unless you specifically ask for it.
Yeah.
And which strikes me as just problematic. Even like I look at like shower installs and they don't automatically build an access panel in for stuff. What they'll do is they'll just put the drywall in and assume that if you have an issue, somebody's going to have to cut the drywall to fix it.
Well, worse than that, they don't put a shutoff valve on right. All of those. So
correct.
If you have a problem there and you need to replace replacing a shower valve, one of those one single controlled jobs, you have to turn off the water in the entire house. You've got if you're in a condo or an apartment, you have to turn off the water for the entire floor.
It's a matter of
to save
builder minimizing cost, both in terms of parts and labor, because by not putting in those access panels and those shutoff valves, they can have the plumbers put in the plumbing first, and then the fitters put in all of the drywall and floors and whatnot.
Yeah. So downstream, it's a great deal for the plumbers and the drywall guys, because they're getting, they know the drill. They go in there and, you know, it's hundreds of dollars more to do what should have been a pretty simple job.
Yeah. But we cut corners. We cut corners like this all the time from an IT perspective.
Well, I mean, you look at the, it's the same thing, right? You know, average tenure of CIO of 3 or 4 years. It's like, well, I don't need to put an access panel in this ERP upgrade.
I'll be long gone by then.
I'll be long gone. Yeah. And how am I going to sell the additional work to put the access panel in the ERP system to the board?
But at the same time, we're walking past all the technical debt. I mean, we're all guilty of this, but it's this, I've been in a house where we had a fuse panel or a screw-in fuse panel, and everything was fine until it caught on fire.
There you go.
And then we upgraded.
That's your reason for patching your cyber and your security. It's also your reason for using data governance. It's also your reason
for testing your backups.
By the way, changing the switches and the plugs, that's data quality.
And changing your backup strategies and how you do incrementals versus full backups, all of that. Same issue. We'll do incremental backups and we'll spread them all around the data center, because it's too much problem to change all of those cron jobs and all the batch, and then it bites you. Somebody makes a change and you're dead meat. You're out of luck. So
I got a story like that. So when we were doing our first production implementation for the Matrix at Homestar Mortgage Corp, I told the integration guy, is like, no, we're not going to look at any of the integration code at all. All we're going to do is look at what data is going in and what data is coming out. And then we're going to use the Matrix to connect it so that the stuff going out looks like exactly like what was going out before. I don't want to see your 10,000 lines of code. And I got pushback, not just from him, but also from my chief engineer as well. And I'm like, wow, there's a weird sort of mind thing going on here, because basically what I'm proposing is that we're just going to rip and replace, as opposed to trying to rework something that is, you know, not, but there was this whole sort of psychological resistance to that, which, you know, I mean, I kind of expect that in general, but in this situation, I didn't, because I was the one that was leading the project and I thought I was communicating really well. And
now, did any of these people have a kind of an emotional vested interest? Had they actually worked on any of these?
Oh, yeah. Well, the integration guy was the guy that wrote the spaghetti code.
There you go.
And he ended up getting himself fired because he wouldn't play ball. You know, so I guess. You know.
You've put your finger right on it, right there.
That was the biggest learning I had in 2023, is that, you know, so I finally figured out that what I'm trying to sell is lean and agile for data engineering. The Matrix is just the substrate.
Right.
And every time I talk to a CTO or a chief data officer, if they have any sort of vested interest in the current stuff, they don't want to talk to me at all.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter if I can increase productivity by 1,000%. It doesn't matter, because they're still, you know, they were the ones that put those outlets in the wall 50 years ago, and they did a great job. So there's no need to rip all of that stuff out and redo it.
Well, there's a balance though on, you know, how, when this is going to, what, you know, it's how do you, you know, a home fire is an easy way to potentially say that's the risk, but it's, you know, if I went to my spouse and said, hey, we need to, you know, replace all the aluminum wiring, and said, and I said, you know, I'm not sure where it is. I know it's in this room, and I have no idea what the, you know, at some point you get that look, and you're like, how imminent is the threat? And that you end up saying, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that would be like moving to zero trust, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, who's going to pay for that?
Out of whose budget does it come? Right.
And yeah, the fire is like a breach. The fire is like a cybersecurity breach.
But go ahead, Rich.
Well, actually, for you and Rob.
Yeah.
One of the things that used to actually prevent some of what you're just describing is when you had development separated from test, separated from ops.
Yeah.
Because there was a clear, immediate, you know, supplier-customer relationship. And the customer was right there, very, you know, chronologically right there next to the producer, the developer.
Yeah.
And they're sitting there going, no, I got to think downstream. I'm trying to, you know, I want you to invest in my future when they talk to dev or talk to test. So here's the question. Does the DevOps consolidation, does that promote this kind of behavior, both in terms of not necessarily that the product quality is bad, but you don't think about futures the same way, or you don't think about renovations the same way?
That's a really interesting point, Rich. That really is. Because I think about, like, it comes down to how much you care about the future. If you're moving to a DevOps model, you're thinking about productivity and efficiency as well as as quality, right? And if that mindset doesn't exist in the organization, you're not going to be successful implementing DevOps in the organization.
Are you though?
Go ahead.
What I was going to say is, my answer to Rich's initial question is, yes, it does promote that behavior. And no, it is not good in the sense of being future forward, especially when you come to think about what the impact of AI is going to be. And how is that actually going to work? Because now you're going to add, what, AI ops on top of DevOps and StackOps and all the other opses, and oops, there goes the ball game. The separation, I coming from that part of the frame that says DevOps and QA and testing are separate and distinct for a reason, I still ascribe to that. It's not to say I don't appreciate DevOps or platform engineering or anything of that ilk. It's that in principle, I think it's a better way because it reinforces SDLC that you could actually govern it for the future.
So, yeah. And yeah. You get kind of that sort of separation of duties thing, right? Where you're not the builders aren't the testers.
Right.
And that's where the office is from, or permits even. There's a lot of analogies here for good separation of duties. And building codes are structured to require people to follow, right, good practice and actually exactly. Delivery minimum standards and stuff like that. Oh, my goodness.
And to save lives.
Well, there's your governance, right?
Yeah. There's a stewardship aspect that nobody talks about with DevOps. And that stewardship is the part that I believe is missing from the conglomeration called DevOps that is that future forward view. What's going to happen when? What's going to happen in not 6 months from now or the fifth iteration from now, or the next scrum, it's what's going to happen when the next big wave of technology hits. Am I automagically creating technical debt for what I'm doing now? And that stewardship is something that I think we're going to see a lot of in 2024. The need for it and the desire for it.
How do you
design for it? I hope you're right. I don't know if I agree with that. Maybe I'm cynical, but I'm looking at it like, all right, I mean, does this come back to the whole, you know, Peter Drucker and, you know, greed is good and, you know, the shortening time horizons of publicly traded companies and this, it seems like stewardship and business leadership is lacking in general, like consistently across all of sectors and industries.
Yeah, and here's why it's going to make a comeback. It's called Gen AI.
Oh,
yeah, I think that has potential as well.
I wouldn't even go as far as that. Like what Rob and I were talking about at the beginning, like software supply chain guidelines and such, those are coalescing now. And within the next year or so, there's going to be requirements by regulatory entities to start enforcing good software supply chain, which is again like going back to the whole stewardship and stuff. It's going to become a much more regulated field, at least in places where compliance is required. And it's going to get closer to building codes and things like that. Like we started look down this path essentially when the SolarWinds hack happened. Until then, it was everyone just doing their own thing. But yeah, like if you're looking at the latest CS software supply chain guidelines, it's talking about managing your source code, about managing your build pipelines, but managing your dependencies, your artifacts, and your deployments. So, like when we draw the equivalency there, like it's that there's certainly a plan.
So I don't disagree with that. The question I would put up is, we've been trying to do that for a long time with things like ITIL and COBIT and, you know, scaled agile framework and yada yada yada. Why hasn't that happened already?
Because
that's a great question. Yeah,
because it hasn't been mandatory,
right?
So the newest frameworks, again, in regulated fields, are going to make these practices mandatory now. So all of the companies that have been cutting corners, they have a lot of catching up to do. All of the companies that were at the leading edge of adopting these practices have smooth sailing now.
Yeah, in certain industries as well, right? You know, financial services is more mature generally than a lot of other ones, versus manufacturing light manufacturing on the other extreme.
I don't know about that, because I think there's another factor that needs to be considered into this, particularly for ITIL, which is on the sustainability reporting side.
Okay.
Right? I mean, I'm already seeing this where, excuse me, how do I input into my ERP the necessary fields and tables for carbon capture? So sustainability becomes your thing. Right. So I wouldn't say that it's, you know, one industry more than another, but this is where this notion of stewardship is also coming from, in my mind. Not only from the, we need to do this and because of the previous SDLC and the divisions of power, but this notion of stewardship, if you're a company that wants to be, you know, on the record as being sustainably driven, you're now looking at carbon capture throughout your supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you implement that? And those are best practices that are not yet written into ITIL or any of the other things, but those in my mind fall under the word stewardship.
Well, there's definitely a lot
regulatory
of
regulatory compliance.
I find myself playing devil's advocate today. That's all right. So GDPR, right? You know, in 2017, we rebranded the company to PrivOps because we were planning on using the matrix to solve operational risk or mitigate operational risk of complying with GDPR, right? And what we found out was that nobody cared. The CIOs that we talked to, you know, you talk to them in the, during the, you know, working hours, and they're like, oh yeah, we're fine. We had PwC come in and do an audit, and you know, they blessed us and, you know, sprinkled holy water over our documentation. And then, you know, after the sales dinner and, you know, there are three or four scotches in, they're like, are you kidding? We don't even know where our customer data is.
We ain't got no budget.
And it's ridiculous. We don't even know where the data is, much less have governance in place. I mean, are you kidding? Right. And what the realization we had was that the CIOs were in a no-win situation because if they surfaced risk under GDPR, that's operational risk, then the board's going to be like, well, you're the CIO.
Fix it.
Why didn't you fix this before?
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
And they're like, so for them, it's in their best interest to just keep quiet and let Capgemini come in and do their thing and sign off on it and just kind of whistle past the graveyard. And it's like, okay, so there's this organizational WIFM versus the personal WIFM, and there's this agency conflict that makes stewardship difficult. And I think, Joanne, you're absolutely right. You're talking about stewardship. It's just a question of where does it come from, and how do we encourage it to develop? And that's going to be about how we structure our organizations, our culture. That's all the people side of the equation, right? And
not necessarily.
A lot of it.
Yeah, I mean,
a lot of it is, but there's some of it that's technical as well. You have to account.
Yeah, it's that whole iteration. But I think it starts with the people. That if you've got a situation where you've got somebody who's in charge of IT, who is afraid to surface real issues to the rest of the business because there is no benefit to them to do so. There's actually a detriment to them personally to do so.
That's why you need
that's a really challenging issue.
That's why you need a separate compliance officer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not that their interests are at odds with each other. The idea of separating the compliance office from the CIO is A, to give your company to make sure that you're enforcing compliance, and B, to give the CIO the capability of saying like, okay, someone else needs to tell me about it because I cannot keep at the top of the most recent compliance regulations. And if they do work together, The other part also, like going back to what ITIL is, like the shortcomings on that. I mean, if you don't have a RISI chart, then you then you cannot stay compliant. Like you need to know who is responsible, who's accountable.
It's accountability, exactly.
Yeah,
but Klaus, I would add to your point of a compliance officer. The person who's going to compel more stewardship than anyone else is going to be the CFO, because carbon capture, as an example, through a supply chain, has tax ramifications. It has business ramifications, and that stewardship over any related issue under sustainability, and that could be, by the way, why you would, you know, upgrade your heat pump, Rob, okay, to your legacy argument, is going to have direct relationship to how the carbon crediting and carbon taxing and all of that comes into play. That's where
it should be, and then it that gets into our whole. Where does the CIO report to the CFO or to the CEO? I'm thinking of a scenario, a friend of ours who's a data governance person. Recently left a job at a very large corporation, and she was chief compliance and data governance and compliance, and reported into one of the VPs that reported to the CFO. Mm-hmm. And the reason she left was because the CIO and Deloitte were in cahoots to prevent folks in the CFO's office and within that sphere of influence from having any sort of influence over roadmap or direction or anything. So there was this major conflict between the CFO and the CIO.
Oh, they're trying to set her up to fail. They're trying to
where they were actually setting her up to be the scapegoat. And I'm wondering, going, okay, well, you know, to get operational here for a minute, what would I tell her to do different? Basically, I told her, yeah, it's a good idea. You need to find a new job with a new company, because this situation's not tenable for you.
To Joanne's point, what I'm hearing from an industry perspective is this renewed interest in platform engineering, which in a lot of cases is really just IT. But it's this idea that we've let these teams go, and it's going back to the house analogy, it's like having nobody is using building codes. Everybody's picking whatever their favorite thing is. Sometimes they're picking the cheap thing. Sometimes they're picking the most expensive thing because they want to do it that way. And nobody's worried about intermixing anything. The safety standards are all over the place. And IT is coming back and being like, I actually can't, all these short-term decisions I've made are actually getting really expensive. Even the teams, and this is what I think is fascinating here, even the teams who've done the best work and done, used the newest standards and the zero trust infrastructure and things like that, even if they've done everything right, it still is potentially causing IT problems for the organization because none of it's integrating together.
It's mm-hmm. happening in the automotive industry as well. Like Tesla, yes, mm-hmm. we gotta give them credit for being disruptive and pushing forward a lot of innovations, but they also made a lot of really, really bad quality and UX decisions. Like, for example, in some of their newer models, they don't have a turn signal rod anymore. They have buttons on the steering wheel.
What?
Now, if you're in a roundabout and your steering wheel is upside down, those buttons are reversed.
Oh my God.
I thought those were actually regulatory requirements.
Apparently not. But it turns out that some of the driving test centers in Norway are starting to refuse to test people driving those vehicles because of that.
That's a really, really interesting example. Yeah, no, some of the, this to me is what's so fascinating if you watch it, that, fundamentally houses are designed for people, and a lot of the stuff that we have, you know, is you know, hasn't changed that much, or we've intentionally maintained the systems because there's utility in maintaining the systems in yep. certain ways, right? Even if I put in new plugs or new switches, it's that, you know, there's still value in maintaining some of the legacy pieces at the moment. Right.
Another example, we're
out of time, but go ahead, finish your thought. I we don't have to run, but
another example being the Tesla trucks. So the driver's seat is in the middle of the
is
cabin.
Is it really?
Yeah. So it's not on one side, which seems fine, like from like being able to see around your truck. The problem comes when you actually try to do your day to day tasks, like for example, handing paperwork at the gate, because you have to get out of your seat now.
To pay a toll or to scan a card or show an ID.
Yep.
They put the driver's seat in the middle?
Yep.
So I'll never buy a Tesla because I can't even reach from when the seat is in the appropriate place. Yep. I still have to open the door and get out.
Well, you also want to make sure that, for example, your rear wheels don't fall off. And
yeah.
Well, how are you going to get your Chick-fil-A at the drive-thru?
We don't have Chick-fil-A up here.
They do now.
That's sad.
Oh, okay.
You.
Well, not in my neck of the woods. Anyway, I got to scoot, guys. Yeah,
this is good. I love how passionate we got about this. Maybe we'll come back to it. next week, we're back to data. So, cool. Thank you all. Have a good one.
All right.
Bye.
Cheers.
Wow, that was fun. I really got a lot of great ideas for the presentation I'm working on, but even more, I learned a lot both about house and construction and IT and operations. A lot of interesting things to think about team dynamics, how to invest in paying down technical debt, and how to invest in avoiding technical debt in the future. If this was informative and helpful to you, and I hope it was, come join our discussion groups. The more, the merrier. We really enjoy having a lot of different points of view here, as you can tell. You can find out that all about it and our schedule and past episodes at the2030.cloud. I'll see you there. Thank you for listening to the Cloud 2030 podcast. It is sponsored by RackN, where we are really working to build a community of people who are using and thinking about infrastructure differently. Because that's what RackN does. We write software that helps put operators back in control of distributed infrastructure, really thinking about how things should be run and building software that makes that possible. If this is interesting to you, please try out the software. We would love to get your opinion and hear how you think this could transform infrastructure more broadly. Or just keep enjoying the podcast and coming to the discussions and laying out your thoughts and how you see the future unfolding. It's all part of building a better infrastructure operations community. Thank you.